regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with NRA ILA Executive Director John Comerford here in a moment or two. Man, a lot to talk about. It was, we had him on a week ago, last Tuesday, and it seemed like it was like maybe an hour or so after we got done with that interview. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals came down with its decision striking down New Mexico's 7-day waiting period. That was a case the NRA was involved in. And they have been going through a lot of litigation since then, a number of new cases filed to talk about. So let's kick off the conversation with NRA ILA Executive Director John Comerford. Take a look and a listen. John, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Always happy to be here.
I think we might have to make this a regular Tuesday appearance because honestly, you guys are so busy over at NRA right now. We were just talking right before we hit record. So we had you on last Tuesday talking about the Duncan case out of California. And then almost right after we got done with that interview, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals comes out and says New Mexico's 7-day waiting period is unconstitutional. That's a case that the NRA had brought. Since then, we've got lawsuits filed in Massachusetts challenging the state's ban on so-called assault weapons, which encompasses almost every semi-automatic firearm outside of, you know, rimfire rifles. And then just today, like a couple of minutes before we sat down here, NRA sends out a press release, another lawsuit, this one taking on Florida's 3-day waiting period on gun sales. So building off of that success out of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. I'll ask you, John, where do you want to get started? Because there's a lot to discuss today.
And I can't remember if we hit on this last time, but don't forget Florida filing their reply to our cert petition on the under 21 case in support of our position, which is sort of unprecedented. And we had the Third Circuit, New Jersey, taking the unprecedented step of calling for an en banc hearing on their own. So it's been busy.
It has been.
I'll start wherever you want.
All right. Well, you know, let's go broad topic then. Let's talk about these hardware cases, you know, both in Massachusetts, the new lawsuit that was filed, the action by the Third Circuit, which is, you know, I think unprecedented or not unprecedented because we actually saw this with the Fourth Circuit and Snope. But what's different here in the Third Circuit, it seems, is that, you know, the Fourth Circuit, and I hate it because that's the jurisdiction where I live and I think where you live as well. This has become a court that is so hostile to our right to keep and bear arms. The Third Circuit, on the other hand, you would think about New Jersey having some of the most restrictive gun laws on the books. Third Circuit was responsible for, you know, Range versus Garland, saying that Brian Range should not have his Second Amendment rights denied because of a falsification of a food stamp application 20 plus years ago, that doesn't make him a dangerous person. That was a great decision and one that the federal government decided not to appeal. You've had some other good decisions, including, I think, the Paris cases out of Pennsylvania regarding right to carry for 18, 19 and 20 year olds. So I think there's every indication, and I don't want to assume too much, but there's at least an indication that with the Third Circuit deciding to take this New Jersey semi-auto ban case en banc before the 3-judge panel has a chance to issue its decision, that maybe this en banc panel is going to say, yeah, you know what? These laws are unconstitutional.
Yeah, and the makeup of that court may even evolve in the Second Amendment's favor between now and when they actually hear that case. So there's it has changed even in the last year. So that's very encouraging. And remember, NRA has a challenge there. We have a challenge with ANJRPC related to hardware for firearms and for magazines. And then that case was combined with others. I think it's a cornucopia of gun groups there. And this is before a lot of us started to work together, because remember, a lot of these are legacy cases, but you have, I believe it's Cheeseman with FPC, SAF, and others. So that's a combined group. I think it's encouraging to see where that goes. And then remember, we have the Seventh Circuit coming up in Illinois. We have this new challenge in Massachusetts, and then obviously mags in Duncan. So there's quite a bit going on in related to hardware. And at some point, this court's going to have to take one of these cases. But you got to stagger them out so they hit at different times. But it's encouraging to see what they did in the Third Circuit. I don't think they did that just to beat the law down. or to support the law and beat our challenge down. But I'm cautiously optimistic there.
I am too. And you know, this is a case for folks who don't remember, because again, there was a lot of lawsuits to try to keep stock of and keep track of. The U.S. district judge in this case ruled that New Jersey's ban on the Colt AR-15 specifically was unconstitutional. And, you know, he basically said, well, this is the gun that the plaintiffs focused on, so that's the only gun that I'm really going to talk about, even though New Jersey statute obviously encompasses a lot of other guns. He didn't say that the statute was constitutional as applied to all these other firearms. He just said, well, that's where most of the argument was, so that's where I'm going to limit my decision to. So now you've got the Third Circuit, which has the opportunity to, again, broaden that decision. But it was initially, it wasn't a bad decision from the U.S. District Judge. It just didn't go as far as we would have liked to have seen. So oral arguments are scheduled in October in the Third Circuit, scheduled in September in the Seventh Circuit for the Illinois AWB and magazine challenges. Mm-hmm. John, it is possible. I mean, if these appellate courts act with, you know, some speed here, it's possible that the court could get one of these cases next spring, right? I mean, that's when a cert petition could be filed.
Very possible. I'm never optimistic in terms of speed with these appellate courts, but you never know. I mean, anything is possible, and we'll see how quickly the district court gets to this new case out of Massachusetts that we partner with Gun Owners Action League on. I mean, those guys up there, Jim Wallace and that team, and the volunteers in that state, I mean, they're dealing with, you know, as a former New Jersey resident, I feel their pain, right? Dealing with the same thing that we're seeing in Illinois and California and Colorado and Maryland and others. And it's good to be able to bring a challenge with them to try to right that wrong as well. And that piggybacks onto the under 21 challenge that we already had going from earlier this year. So it's got to keep this activity up.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, again, speaking of the under 21 challenge, NRA versus Glass, that is the case that you mentioned earlier, where Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer responded to the NRA cert petition before the Supreme Court, saying, yes, the Supreme Court should take this case, but I don't want to defend this law because I think that it is unconstitutional to deprive 18, 19 and 20 year olds of their ability to purchase a firearm at retail. I don't know that this is unprecedented, but it certainly is unusual to see an attorney general decline to defend a state law. And, you know, Uthmeyer argued if the court wants to appoint an amici to defend Florida's law, let them. But I'm not going to be the one to do it. Do you think that makes this a more compelling case for the court?
Well, absolutely. And look, at the 11th Circuit, we feel they erred just as he did on the side of not providing historical context to support this ban. And I mean, look, it boils down to something pretty simple. If 18 to 20 year olds weren't allowed to possess firearms, this country wouldn't be free today. So that's a tradition worth protecting. They're law abiding adults. They can serve in the military. You know, many often equate it to bans on being able to purchase alcohol or cigarettes or other things. Well, they're not constitutionally protected. You can vote at 18. You should be able to purchase a firearm. And I think that's when it boils down to, this is not a minor law or regulation in the state of Florida. This is what we feel and he feels is an unconstitutional standard. And I think that's why they took that position. You know, he's taken a fresh approach to that office. Not to say his predecessors didn't, but he's taking a different approach, and we're happy to see it. But look, Governor DeSantis called for putting a repeal of this law on his desk, mm-hmm. and we worked very hard. Our members contacted their lawmakers, and unfortunately, we had a Senate president down there who wouldn't let this happen. So this could have been fixed in the legislature, and. You know, we're going to continue to keep fighting for Floridians and get that state where it needs to be, including with our lawsuit from actually last night on the waiting period or the time tax. You know, it's time for that thing to go. That's been around since 1998 on handguns and on since 2018 on all arms. So it's time to fix that as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, the NRA's complaint, I just finished writing a story about forbearing arms about this new lawsuit. Going through the complaint, you know, obviously the 10th Circuit decision, I think, has had an impact in what you guys are alleging here. because the 10th Circuit decision was strong, right? I mean, the state of New Mexico argued, hey, listen, this is a commercial regulation. Supreme Court has said that commercial regulations are presumptively lawful. So, you know, in fact, now this wasn't in their legal brief, but after the 10th Circuit decision, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham argued that because the 10th Circuit also says that 18, 19, and 20-year-olds can't purchase a firearm, that a three-year waiting period is okay, complies with the Second Amendment. 3 years, right? And as you guys point out in your initial complaint against Florida's law, this isn't a commercial regulation on the sale of firearms. This is a regulation on the purchaser of a firearm, right? They've gone through the background check. They've passed a background check. And the state of Florida says, oh, no, you can't take possession of that gun yet because we want this cooling off period for you to reconsider whether or not you really want that gun, right? That flies in the face of our national tradition of gun ownership and certainly the text of the Second Amendment.
And yeah, it's a time tax. It's a time tax on your constitutional right. And I always find it interesting that these anti-gun lawmakers solely focus on individuals who want to purchase a firearm for recreational, other reasons, but not self-defense. What if you have an individual who's facing an imminent threat? You're telling them that, what, oh, get an extra deadbolt and wait 3 to 7, 10, 30 days, 3 years, whatever is acceptable to them at the time. But they're never putting themselves in the shoes of someone who is dealing with imminent threat and imminent harm against themselves or their families and what they need to do to protect themselves. Because, look, as everybody's heard, seconds count, police are minutes away, and you should be able to go find the means to protect yourself however you deem appropriate, particularly with constitutionally protected items like firearms.
Absolutely. And again, in the state of New Mexico, state of Florida, state of New Mexico anyway, you know, again, they've got universal background checks, right? So you're not even able to do a private sale because that's supposed to go through an FFL. The waiting period still applies. There are some carve outs, right? If you have a concealed carry license, you're exempt. And as you guys point out in your a Florida lawsuit, that again cuts against the idea of this being a commercial regulation, because there are some individuals or some classes of individuals who the state of Florida has decided aren't really dangerous, don't need to have that cooling off period. So this isn't a commercial regulation. This is a regulation, again, on some gun buyers. And again, it just flies in the face of history. So I got to say, I'm excited to see all of the lawsuits. I mean, this is a flurry of legal activity going on from the National Rifle Association. It is great to see. And it's great to see, you know, not only these initial complaints, but it's great to see some success now in courts like the 10th Circuit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope everybody stays tuned, because I probably have another one coming this week. Joe Greenlee and our litigation shop, they're grinding away. I mean, the amount of work that they pump out of that office is truly incredible. And also the other Second Amendment groups and their attorneys, they've been great to work with. And that's not just the national groups, that's the local groups as well, like GOAL, ANGRPC, CRPA, and others. It's great to see everybody's renewed focus solely on the greater good, and that's protecting the Second Amendment rights of all of America's gun owners.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, I'm going to be out next week, but can we count on you Tuesday after next?
Sure. Absolutely.
We're going to have like 18 lawsuits to talk about by then. You're right. The rate we're going here, but we'll carve out the time. John, again, I appreciate you carving out a few minutes for us today. Thank you again for everything that you guys are doing. And remember, this is like the slow time of year for the state legislators, right? So we're going to have some legislative news to talk about here in the months ahead, in addition to all of the legal activity that NRA is involved in.
And keep in mind, just to close on that, I'm glad you referenced that. You know, there's a veto override scheduled today in North Carolina on permitless carry. Is the bill perfect? No. It's a step in the right direction. We'll see if they end up having the vote so we can report on that.
Absolutely. John Comerford, NRA ILA Executive Director. Thanks so much for joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company.
Thanks for having me.
My thanks to John for joining me on the program. Looking forward to having him back again here in a couple of weeks. And I don't know if there are going to be 18 new lawsuits filed, but I imagine we're going to have some new cases to discuss. And hopefully good news on permitless carry in North Carolina as well. All right, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Iowa, Here's the headline. Iowa City teen on probation for West High stabbing last year, charged with August shooting. Yeah. So, I mean, again, the obvious question is, why was somebody put on probation for stabbing somebody in the first place, right? So this from CBS2 in Iowa. Iowa police arrested 17-year-old Moyad El-Seed and an unnamed individual in an early morning shooting that took place back on August the 3rd. El-Seed now charged with attempted murder and possession of a firearm as a felon. The other juvenile also charged with possessing a gun as a felon. Police did not name them since the charge is not categorized as a forcible felony. Okay, which is weird because it's a shooting. So you'd think that would, in fact, be a forcible felony, but okay. Police say four people were shot around 2:55 in the morning on August the 3rd. One of the victims taken to the hospital. The other three drove themselves to the hospital. All of them survived. CBS2 in Iowa reports that last August, El-Seed and two others were accused of chasing a victim inside the Iowa City West High School after school was closed, beating and then stabbing them. El-Seed was not a West High student. He was charged with burglary as well as willful injury causing bodily injury. He pleaded guilty in that case to felony charges and received a deferred judgment. So no prison time whatsoever. Supervised probation for, I guess it would have been 3 years. Because he pled guilty in 2024. Probation lasted until 2027. 3 years probation for stabbing and beating somebody? I mean, what the what? That just strikes me as incredibly, egregiously soft punishment for a serious crime. And apparently, El-Seed allegedly agrees with that because it doesn't seem like he took that probation seriously, given that he is now facing charges of shooting multiple people. Of course, you are presumed innocent until proven guilty in court, but we will see what happens with the case of Moayed El-Seed going forward here. Now to today's Armed Citizen story. A bizarre case out of Cincinnati. So here's the headline. He chose to live. Jury finds youth football coach shot parent in self-defense at game. Yeah. Like I said, this is kind of a weird one. So 30-year-old Lamont Reagan found not guilty in a Hamilton County Common Pleas Court on Monday, facing numerous charges, including attempted murder. The shooting happened during an exhibition game for 11 and 12-year-olds last October between Reagan's team, the West End Elite Royals, and the Evanston Bulldogs. Reagan shot a man named Karan Booker, whose son played for the Evanston team. Prosecutors say he did so to get even after he was struck by Booker. Booker was not armed. He was shot in the neck, stomach, and back, surviving the incident. The prosecutor, Rebecca Barnett, said that the video of the incident showed a dispute between kids on the two teams, which led to adults from both sides rushing onto the field. Booker, father of one of the players, runs onto the field, he said, because he thought his son was in danger. Motion for parents on the other team to retrieve their children, she said. And the prosecutor added that while it was Booker's interaction with Reagan that started the fight between the two, she said the tide turned against Booker when adults from Reagan's team joined in, alleging that Reagan had no justifiable fear of a death or great bodily injury, I guess because, you know, he had other parents coming to his defense. Prosecutors say that Reagan had made threats towards Booker at a youth football game 2 weeks before the shooting, saying, I got something for you, while motioning towards his cross body bag. Reagan reached into a similar bag during the fight and retrieved a handgun, opened fire on Booker, according to prosecutors. Reagan's attorney, a man named Will Well, said that Booker testified at trial that the alleged threat was made towards his mother. Well said that Reagan never threatened Booker's mom. He said Mr. Booker's decision to go onto that field may be flawed. The prosecutor said that Booker's decision to go on that field may be flawed, but it wasn't criminal. It did not justify Lamont Reagan shooting him three times. Well, I don't think that was the allegation. I think the allegation was that Reagan didn't shoot Booker just because Booker ran onto the field. Reagan shot Booker because Booker punched him. Well said, Reagan's attorney said he wasn't trying to get revenge. He said there was no purpose here other than to get away. He said his client had gone onto the field to see what the commotion was between the players, but became afraid for his life after an unprovoked attack by Booker. He said that Reagan had been beaten, was choking on his own blood, and couldn't breathe. Felt like an asthma attack was imminent. He reached into his bag. Initially, he said to retrieve his inhaler, but he did knowingly grab his handgun instead. Wells said the man thought he was dying. He felt his gun. He used it. At that moment, Lamont decided to live. Reagan initially fled the scene, turned himself over to authorities the next day. After the trial concluded, Welsh said, I believe the jury did the right thing. They listened to the facts. They applied the law. He said that Booker had no reason to rush onto the field. Certainly had no reason to punch Reagan. He said that his client, relieved with the outcome of the case, wants to put the incident behind him. He said the bottom line was that he had to make a choice that day, and he chose to live. I wasn't in the courtroom. If a jury has concluded that this is self-defense, I got nothing more to add to that other than, I got nothing more to add to that. I will accept the jury's findings here, and I hope that Mr. Reagan is able to move on with his life. I guess, I do have something to add. I don't have kids who are young enough to participate in youth sports anymore. But, you see these stories all the time. Irate parents. Sometimes maybe it's the coach who's to blame, but it seems to me like typically it is a parent who has a problem who escalates that problem to violence against a referee, an umpire, a coach. It's a kid's sport, right? I don't care how good your kid is. I don't care if you think your kid's going to have to play in the pros. Dial it down, man. I mean, honestly, there is nothing going on that field that would justify you getting physically aggressive against another parent, a coach, again, a referee, a player. And if there is something going on in that field that would justify you getting aggressive, maybe your kid doesn't need to be playing in that league. Maybe you need to find another place for them to play, right? Thankfully, I grew up in a time where that never happened. When I was playing, peewee soccer, when I was playing high school football, we just didn't have anything like that. So, yet again, everything is stupid and it's only getting worse. All right, on to today's good deed of the day, something that is not stupid, a father and son who saved a woman from a burning car in Boone County, West Virginia. You can see here the car fully engulfed in flames. That is really scary. And again, I mean, that can happen so quickly. Having my own car caught fire, it was probably 9 years ago now. But before you know it, man, you can just a little puff of white smoke, and then all of a sudden, car is just gone. Boone County deputies say the woman was driving on Monday when her car overturned in a creek and then caught fire. A man named Hayden Johnson was in his work van. When he was flagged down, he was told about the car that was on fire. Johnson jumped out of the van, climbed down into the creek, was able to cut the airbags out of the way, and then pulled the woman out of the car. Deputies say that he then pulled her about 50 yards away from the fire, so she should be safe until emergency crews arrived. I said there's a father and son. Actually, no, it was a 9-year-old kid named Jackson, who apparently lives in the area. He saw the car on fire as well, alerted his mom or his grandmother, who was the one who called 911. Deputies say that Jackson was awarded an ice cream and cookie card from the local McDonald's for making good decisions. Hope Hayden Johnson got a cookie as well for actually pulling the woman out of the car. I mean, not that, a 9-year-old could have done that, but regardless of whether or not Hayden Johnson got the reward from the local fast food place. The woman involved in the crash is expected to make a full recovery. And so in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, Hayden Johnson and a 9-year-old Jackson, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is all we've got for you here on this edition of Barry and Arms Cam and Company. Tomorrow, though, we're going to be talking with Jacob Sullum. He has a new book coming out called Beyond Control, which takes a look at the war on drugs, the war on guns, and what alternatives there are out there to, fight violent crime without infringing on our Second Amendment rights. I guess, what can we do to reduce drug use without throwing people in prison for possessing pot? I'll be honest with you, I probably won't focus a lot on the war on drug side of things, just because of what we talk about here at Buried Arms. But it is a fascinating book. I am more than halfway through reading it. Jacob goes through the history of, you know, the racist drug laws that were put in place in the 1800s, early 1900s, the racist gun laws, which go back even further in this country, excuse me, and then gets into what these laws look like today, even if they are not intentionally a racist in their design, the disproportionate outcomes that happen. And then again, gets into strategies to, you know, deal with public safety, to reduce drug addiction without incarceration. It is a fascinating book. I got to tell you, I mean, the history side of things, I consider myself to be pretty well read. I thought I knew a lot of this history, but there have been several instances where I've been reading this over the last couple of days and had to go to Wikipedia or went online to look up information because I had not heard these stories before, including one incident happened in the 1930s in Gordonsville, Virginia, which is about an hour north of where I live. I've read Nicholas Johnson's Negroes and the Gun. I've read Charles Cobb's This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. And again, I am still learning some new information from Jacob's book. So I even before the interview, I'll tell you, I will recommend this book to you. But I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Jacob Sullum coming up tomorrow. Be sure to check out buryingarms.com throughout the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation, including more details on the NRA's new lawsuit against Florida. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. All you have to do, go to buryingarms.com/subscribe, use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. You'll, if you're a VIP Gold or Platinum member, you can take part in our weekly live chat with Hot Air Zed Morrissey. We do that every Wednesday, 1:30 Eastern. Looking forward to doing that again tomorrow. I'll also be on Newsmax this afternoon in the 5 p.m. Eastern hour with Carl Higbee talking 2A News. Hope to have you be able to tune into that as well. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.